From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a brutal week in a sacred season. Bells ringing today, not in joy, but in sorrow for the dead of Newtown, Connecticut. So many, so young, little children, teachers. It is a challenge to our hearts and souls in a season that celebrates hope. This hour on Point, the spiritual challenge of Newtown. You can join the conversation. How have you absorbed these killings, these deaths in your heart? Are you driven inward to contemplation, to prayer, outward to activism? Are you just sent to your knees? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. The bells this morning in Newtown, Connecticut, 26 times they rang in remembrance of lives lost. Slowly in this church tower, so much grief, so much sorrow in this week. So many dead. At the Interfaith Memorial Service in Newtown on Sunday, President Obama spoke about the fundamental uncertainty of existence, about grappling and groping at a time like this.
We know that no matter how good our intentions, we'll all stumble sometimes in some way. We'll make mistakes. We'll experience hardships. And even when we're trying to do the right thing, we know that much of our time will be spent groping through the darkness, so often unable to discern God's heavenly plans.
Groping in the darkness, believers or otherwise, and especially, though, at this time, this time of year. This was Tuesday, an interview with Channel 11 in Atlanta. Megachurch pastor Andy Stanley said, "Even now, the story of Christmas," he said, is a story for hope, of hope.
There's hope that God can take what's fragile and make it powerful. God can take what's innocent and use it to impact people who've lost their innocence. While what's happened overshadows for many of us the experience of Christmas, it's in the story of Christmas that I think we find the hope that we're all going to need as we move forward.
But it's not easy, and there have been some controversial interpretations. Mike Huckabee, ordained Baptist minister, former candidate for president, took some heat for comments he made last Friday on Fox News. He asked, "Where was God that day in Newtown?" Here's what he said.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. We ask why there's violence in our schools, but we've systematically removed God from our schools. Should we be so surprised that schools would become a place of carnage? Because we've made it a place where we don't want to talk about eternity.
We're talking this hour about the spiritual challenge of the killings in Newtown in this sacred season. And we're turning today to Connecticut, where this blow fell. Joining me now from Hartford is Reverend Josh Pollack. He's an ordained Unitarian minister, leads the congregation at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. That's about 60 miles from Newtown. Reverend Pollack, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's a privilege and an honor to be part of this conversation today.
Very happy to have you. And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Miroslav Wolf, professor of theology at Yale Divinity School, director of Yale's Center for Faith and Culture. He's a big voice on hope and faith who lived through dark times in his own native Croatia. Miroslav Wolf, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. I'm delighted.
We will have listeners of all faiths and of no faith listening today. I think for anybody, we've felt a kind of challenge to our spirits, if not a fully spiritual challenge. And especially at this time of year, Reverend Pollack, I'll come first to you. You've got a flock. You're not far from Newtown. How do you see the members of your flock, if I may call them that, absorbing what we've all been grappling with this week?
We don't use the word flock, but we can call them that. I think they'll appreciate that. And I think the thing to say first is that people are hurting, and they hurt in all different ways. Like you said, we're 60 miles from Newtown, and while we're not directly impacted, and I feel safe saying it's not the same as being in Newtown.
Of course.
We also knew there'd be a ripple effect, and that as the day progressed on Friday, we'd find out there are people who knew people, or people who we knew who used to live in Newtown, or people who taught in the Newtown public schools, or people who knew first responders, and that sure enough did happen. And there were so many tears, and I would say people were traumatized. I have the sense that the whole nation was traumatized.
Miroslav Volf, many people, you know, in most years look to this time of year without a lot of thought, or maybe with deep prayer, but it's easy to talk about hope and joy. And then here comes an event like this, so tragic, and having moved so many people to the opposite of hope and joy, to sorrow and despair. How do these things stand side by side? How can they? Do they live together?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Those bells ringing, reminders of this horrendous violence.
Again and again.
And you almost feel like a kind of dark cloud has descended upon the season of joy. You know, I sometimes think that we have maybe a bit sanitized Christmas. Christmas and his whole Advent season is about jingling of bells, about sweets, about chubby Santas with kids on his lap, with about presents, about cheer. And that's all true. At the same time, it comes in the darkest time of the year. And it reminds us also that Christmas is the coming of something new into what has been and what is broken. And just think about first Christmas. It was no different in many ways, right? It is this child, fragile child that is born, and it's born in the world in which a brutal Herod rule, and according to the stories in the New Testament, he slaughters the innocent. Mm-hmm. And I think that this juxtaposition of the innocence of the child, of bringing of a new hope, of bringing of the Savior, which is the name for Jesus, and the brutality of the lives in which we lead, that this is the world of Christmas. And I think it's in this world that the Christmas brings hope.
But there, in the Christmas story, just in this faith tradition, and of course there are many, and there will be people, we'll have many listeners who don't have any, but it's a story of light into darkness. And here, Miroslav, we have darkness on top of darkness. In the face of that, what's the message?
You know, there's a nice little phrase that is describing the father of all three Abrahamic faiths, the Abraham himself. Mm-hmm. It is said in the New Testament about him that he hoped against hope. And I think that in many ways, this is what describes Christmas. You know, we think of hope as kind of a based on the circumstances in which we find ourselves. But you can think of hope against circumstances. I think it was Václav Havel who said that hope is a condition of the soul, not response to circumstances. And that's what you see in the story of Abraham. He hopes against hope that he is going to become the father of many nations, he who is old and Sarah is old and who cannot have children, and yet he hopes. And it is in these impossible situations that I think the true nature of hope arises. This is, I think, the story of Christmas.
But Reverend Pollock, in a season like this year, as you may look at mankind and think, many may, it's just irretrievably flawed. Hope less, Josh.
Mm-hmm. I have a 6-year-old, and I look into his face. I have a 10-year-old too, and I think anyone who's looked into the face of a child of that age sees an openness to the world and a sense that anything is possible. And we often get that from children. You look at the pictures of the children who were murdered on Friday, and you see that same openness, those smiles, those wonderful eyes, and that for me is hope, and it tells me that hope is the human condition.
It's those children are dead.
Yeah,
in Newtown.
But it's the way we're born, and this assault was an assault on hope. It was an assault on hope, and so you're right. We're at this place of despair, and it's not going away. And I think one of the things I said this past Sunday was, especially those of us who aren't right there in Newtown, but are looking in and feeling somewhat helpless, feeling somewhat hopeless, mm-hmm. feeling the despair, we have some obligation to the people of Newtown to find our grounding. That needs to be our work in this Christmas season and in the wake of this violence. We need to do whatever we can do to begin recovering it. And I don't pretend for a minute that that's easy.
To find our grounding just when we may feel like completely thrown off. I mean, so many people, Miroslav, you must have seen it in New Haven. You're not so far. So many people just feeling bereft in this year's season.
Yeah, like the ground was taken from under their feet. You know, you mentioned that I come from the region which has experienced a lot of suffering. In my story is also a story of my father when he was 18 years old, who was going through death marches after World War II in the communist labor camps and communist labor camps. And when he was at the total end of his strength and just about to die, an emaciated 100-pound leftover of a man, he somehow there discovered the love of God, and it changed absolutely everything for him, gave him new hope.
Silent Night from the New York City Children's Chorus. It was on Saturday Night Live to open last week. We're talking about the spiritual challenge of the killings in Newtown in this sacred season. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the spiritual challenge of the killings in Newtown, Connecticut, in this sacred season for many. We're grappling with the sorrow, the despair, the questions in what is supposed to be a season of hope. Reverend Josh Pollock joins us from Hartford, Connecticut. He's parish minister at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut, just 60 miles or so from Newtown, where the terrible killings occurred a week ago today. Miroslav Volf is with us, also from Connecticut, New Haven. He's professor of theology at Yale Divinity School, director of Yale's Center for Faith and Culture. You can join the conversation this hour. How are you absorbing the tragedy in Newtown, the horror? Is it turning you inward to contemplation, to prayer? Is it turning you outward to activism, to action? Is this about innate evil? Many people grappling with this in recent days. Here at the Interfaith Service, this was on Sunday in Newtown, Jason Graves of the Al-Hadaya Islamic Center in Newtown offered up this prayer.
We ask God to grant those lost a special place in paradise, and we ask their families to be granted the strength to endure the unendurable. It is in such times of almost unbearable loss that we seek the comfort with our Creator, and that artificial divisions of faith fall away to reveal a nation of mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, all united in a desire to bring healing and renewed hope.
The Interfaith Service in Newtown there on Sunday, Jason Graves of the Al-Hadaya Islamic Center, and here Rabbi Shaul Praver of Temple Adat Israel in Newtown, talking with NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, just one day after his town's tragic mass shooting. Host Scott Simon asked Rabbi Praver simply, why do these sorts of things happen? Here's the rabbi's response the day after the shootings.
I don't know the answer to that. I never try to present a theological answer to that. I think that it's more important just to have compassion and humanity and hold someone's hand and hug them and cry with them.
But we will ask the question, why, again today with Josh Pollack and Miroslav Volf. Let's go to our callers. Megan in Worcester, Massachusetts. Megan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm a 29-year-old mother and teacher. I'm originally from Connecticut. And for me, I'm juxtaposing these incidents with the 9/11 incidents. I was a freshman in college at that time. away from home for the first time, and I kind of sprung to action then. As part of my student council, we set up a crisis center and had a blood drive, went down to New York City and visited with fellow college students that were suffering. But now I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help. I've kind of gone inward to my husband and my son. I've had a tough time going to work all week. I've been taking half days home with my son in the morning and then to my students in the afternoon. And I'm just searching. I'm searching for a way to help. I'm searching for a way to do good. And I just don't know what to do. I'm at a loss.
Let me bring it to my guest today, Megan. I think many people feel just the same way you do. I'll take it to Miroslav Volf and Josh Pollack. Josh, I mean, you had a kind of, for your congregation last week, Sunday, I guess, you had a kind of a formula here. Part of it goes back to a Hebrew phrase, tikkun olam, to heal the world. But not only that, what you had sort of three steps. You mentioned one, but take us through what you were advising, Josh.
My advice was, well, actually, it's actually four steps, and then the first is to notice that hopelessness and the caller's sense of I don't know what to do, and the exasperation and the frustration and the anger and the rage and that questioning of why. But I said we all get to have that. That's a very natural response. But then we need to find our grounding, and that's hard to do, but we need to go into that inner place, or to go into prayer or contemplation, or to go outside and touch the ground. That's actually been my practice, is just to go in my backyard and lie down in the leaves that I didn't rake up. That's very grounding for me.
And but what does that mean, to find your grounding? What do you mean exactly?
Well, what I mean is it has to do with what's coming next. We have to, in some way, attend to the suffering. This assault on hope has created so much suffering, and I don't think we do that well if we're not grounded, if we don't feel some sense of solidness underneath us, if we don't have some sense of faith and some sense of hope back in our lives. And I don't
so
think
just
it's
slow
easy.
Down first. Resist the panic kind of feeling of despair, perhaps.
And so many people over the weekend, especially the pundits, started assessing what happened. And I feel, how can you really give an honest assessment if you haven't had a chance to grieve, if you haven't had a chance just to sit with this and to take in the horror? But that's the next step, is attending to the suffering. And we may not be able to attend to the suffering directly to the people in Newtown. I for one, would only want to be invited before I showed up there. But we need to focus on that. And if it's not the people of Newtown, there's suffering everywhere. And maybe this will open our hearts to being more present to that suffering. And then, after we've dealt with that, tikkun olam, that's the Hebrew notion of repairing the world. And there, many faith traditions have their notion. We speak of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations in the Unitarian Universalist churches. And I'm very hopeful that people will engage in that work of repair and healing when the time is right.
Miroslav Volf, what about for those people who... I mean, this is not the first time something like this has happened. There are many horrors in the world. We hear about them and see about them all the time in the media. I mean, people, there's a temptation to lose faith in goodness itself.
You know, it's interesting in terms of experience of suffering, but it does. Especially for those of us who observe, we kind of rebel against it for the most part. And we think, how can such things be happening in the world that we think is good? But many people who actually find themselves in sufferings, they are kind of split in some ways. In many ways, they then long for the consolation of God's presence. Jack was talking about this, taking a moment of silence, and then the other bookend of it is trying to change the world. But I think in the middle of it lies kind of the sense of, at least in my tradition from which I come, rediscovery, that we are not alone. And that rediscovery happens when we look at the cross of Christ and know and meditate upon this horrendous loss and understand that the resurrection is coming. This is the birth of hope. The birth of hope is in the utter depths of despair. our souls are opened up to the one who holds the whole world in his own hands.
So all of your hope comes from a religious faith in some kind of redeemed future. I mean, some people may not hold that faith or may not hold it so vividly. Does it all depend on that, you know, there's a resurrection, there's a point down the road? What about now?
Well, that is the point that it is now. That's what I started mm-hmm. saying with my father's transformation, right? Mm-hmm. There is a point in which hope is born, and circumstances may be exactly as they were before, and yet there is a hope, and therefore the whole world is different. I think it doesn't necessarily depend on people's faith. What it depends on, in my judgment, is on the reality of the goodness of this world and the world being held in God's hands. Whether people realize it or not, hope is sometimes born in surprising places. The beauty arises out of the vilest of situations, and then we observe and we rejoice. But we can find consolation for ourselves and consolation for those who have departed in the expectation of the future. You know, one just brief point. Mm. After World War II, Jewish thinker Marx Horkheimer was deeply troubled by this thought that the torturer will eternally triumph over the victims. Hmm. And then he, in expectation of the presence of God and the judgment of God setting a right of the world, he found solace and hope. So he discovered somebody who, what he calls the one who is completely different in the situation of the yearning for justice. And in many of these dark moments, I think they can open us up to something larger than ourselves and therefore give us grounding on which to stand and engage in change of circumstances today.
Maybe. If this is opening, it's a painful opening. Kevin in Cheshire, Connecticut. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking?
What can I think? This was an area that I grew up in the next town over. Newtown was the rival football team, you know?
Yeah.
It was my childhood, this area. And this state and everyone is just reeling. I'm a school teacher. I teach kindergarten, and this could have happened in my school or any school. And I respect everyone's opinion on gun control and finding faith and everything, but I'm empty. I'm not even at that process of understanding it all. And this has been a topic ever since Columbine. And I don't know what to think. And I have a daughter, and I have a newborn on the way. And they're going to understand that it's just the way things are before they're 10 years old.
Is it you're feeling an emptiness, Kevin? Is it personal? Is it bigger than that? Is it just you because you're close to Newtown? You're a kindergarten teacher? Well, full sympathy, my gosh.
I mean, those two things obviously had more impact. I'm not saying I'm grieving more than anyone else, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just I'm 41 years old, and over the last decade, I've lost count of how many things of this nature happen. And I'm you know, we're in a country where, well, you know, what bad could happen next? It can't get any worse than this. And then this just upped the ante again. And I'm just, I don't know how to feel. I mean, shouldn't everyone be feeling this? I mean, since the first tragedy has happened back in 99, and there are numerous incidents that weren't even televised, I mean, isn't that enough for anyone? I mean, I hear, oh, well, people are shuffling their feet, and we're starting to talk about, what do you mean starting to talk about this? When is enough? When is this emptiness going to go? Like, why even bother, you know?
Kevin, I appreciate your call, and love to your children, and love to you, the school children in your kindergarten class, and I hope you convey that to them. Reverend Pollock, I mean, here's this feeling of, you know, this has happened, and it's happened again, and it's happened again, and a feeling in Kevin's case, and he's saying maybe beyond, of sort of running on empty. How do you address that?
Kevin, my heart goes out to you, and The one thing I know is that you're not alone, and you may have done this, but I've talked to people all over the country who are feeling that same sense of emptiness, and I think there's despair and some outrage and again, exasperation. Why are we still talking about this? Why does this still keep happening? And I really resonate with your sense that your daughters are going to grow up thinking this is how the world is. And that would also be a tragedy. And I know maybe for me, the grounding comes when you go and you hug your daughters and you look into their eyes and I hope that you see hope in their eyes. And I also am mindful that ultimately, when these things happen, how the world ends up afterwards has to do with how we respond. And
you mean contemplation, action beyond contemplation?
Yeah, action beyond contemplation. But if Kevin is feeling empty, like so many people are, I don't want to urge him to action right now because I'm not sure he'll engage in skillful action. And I want Kevin just to breathe. I think that's the simplest place. That's the place to start, is to breathe. And I have some faith that in breathing and centering, he will get at some point to the recovery that Professor Volk talks about, that recovery of himself, that recovery of the hope that perhaps he had as a child, because that's what we need in order to move forward in a skillful way and an effective way. That's what we need in order to engage in healing.
Breathing's a pretty basic beginning, but maybe it takes us to life. Kevin, thanks for calling. Liz in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I want to comment. It's Christmas. We talk about the Christ child, but what I really want to talk about is the man that he was and what he said when he was about to be given over, that he said, those who use the sword will sooner or later be destroyed by it. We are destroying our children. We are as much to blame for what happened as Adam Lanza is by allowing these weapons, by allowing the violence in TV and video games and films. There was no gray area in what he said. It was black and white. We do not need these kind of weapons. There is no reason for it. It's an immaturity on the part of men or women who feel they need to surround themselves with guns and can't solve their problems reasonably.
Liz, our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call. Miroslav Volf, what about this idea of even a tragedy like this as an expression or a reaction, an inevitability rising from the way we live, from what we tolerate in our midst?
I think there's very much. It seems to me that's quite right. And I think that the caller rightly points back to Jesus. Other spiritual teachers have done the same. Emphasis on fearing not. Emphasis on leading one's life irrespective of the kind of violence that we see around us, and somehow finding a space in which the resentment that this kind of violence creates in us can be dissipated. And then acting out of the purity of the heart, and not out of fear, but out of hope. I think that's the struggle with which we are going right now, to calm ourselves, to act, then be able to act out of hope rather than out of fear.
Miroslav Volf at Yale's Divinity School, please stand by there. Reverend Josh Pollack at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. Monday night on NBC's The Voice, the show opened with a poignant rendition of Hallelujah, each singer holding up a card with the name and age of each of those who died at Sandy Hook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the spiritual challenge of the killings in Newtown, Connecticut, in this sacred season grappling with the sorrow, the despair, the questions, in what is supposed to be a season of hope. Miroslav Volf is with us. He's professor of theology at the Yale Divinity School, director of Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Reverend Josh Pawlik is with us, parish minister at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. Everybody's looking for a way to take this on board, to fit this, find a place for this in their sense of the world, find a way forward after lots of talk about violence, our culture, guns. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, quiet for most of the week, but today in Washington, they held a big press conference, and the largest gun rights lobby there. Here's their chief executive, Wayne LaPierre of the NRA, this morning. Here's their thinking, their response to what we saw last week.
Politicians passed laws for gun-free school zones. They issue press releases bragging about them. They post signs advertising them. And in doing so, they tell every insane killer in America that schools are the safest place to inflict maximum mayhem with minimum risk.
There's one response, a political response to the killings that we could go from the head of the NRA. It doesn't sound like a lot of movement there. The big call from the NRA today, as we all try to figure out how to take these killings on board, was to boost safety in schools. Again, Wayne LaPierre, CEO of the NRA.
I call on Congress today to act immediately to appropriate whatever is necessary to put armed police officers in every single school in this nation, and to do it now, to make sure that blanket safety is in place when our kids return to school in January.
There's one answer today from the NRA. Put armed police officers in every single school in this nation. Blanket safety with armed police officers. How are you taking the tragedy in Newtown on board? Where are the answers that you're seeking? Dan in Watertown, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I wanted to bring a little historic perspective to the overall holiday that I think could be helpful to all of us, and that is we keep talking about the season of hope. Today's the winter solstice. It's the shortest, darkest day of the year.
Yep.
And historically, going back centuries, a lot of people would actually take the week or two before the winter solstice and go into a really quiet contemplation and reflection over all that was lost that year, whether it be a parent, a friend — I lost two friends to cancer this summer myself — or the senseless, tragic death of 20 young children and the six adults charged with educating them. This time of year was not supposed to be just a season of hope. It's a season where we go into the darkness to actually realize the miracle of the light and the hope. And I think people need to look more towards the natural signs out here. I find it ironic that today happens to be an incredibly windy, heavy, rainy day on this darkest day of the year overall of New England. I don't think that's just a coincidence. And I think what these people would then do is tomorrow is going to be a little lighter. And that's when they would realize that the sun was not going to keep drifting away from the earth and that we were all going to perish, but that there was some hope, that the sun was returning, that the light was returning.
But Dan, isn't this darkness a little deeper than the solstice? I mean, this is human mayhem, murder. It's more than just a lack of sunshine we're talking about here, isn't it?
Absolutely, Tom, and I think, but as was the car bombs in Afghanistan last week and all the tragic death in Syria, it's every year that humanity exists from now till eternity, unfortunately, there's going to be senseless death and tragedy and stupid wars. We don't seem to be able to rise above that. So what we have to do is honor those losses, and I think we've forgotten to do that. We're doing it now because of this incredibly dark tragedy that's happened in Newtown.
Yeah, Dan, I appreciate your call. If I may, let me take it. Miroslav Volf, to you. I mean, you've seen darkness in the Balkans, in Croatia. You know it there. I mean, some people have responded. You know, Dan says, here we are, contemplate, the light comes again. But this sense of, I mean, some have responded saying, look, there will always be evil. And I don't know if that's leads us to hopelessness or to pick our souls up or to actually get out and act in such a way to try and change the prevalence of evil.
And in fact, if you observe the history, there has been evil throughout history. It's likely to continue to be evil. But I think hope is described not in some kind of facile thinking that somehow the world will magically become a different place, but hope is manifest that in this world drenched with evil, we as individuals, shot through with hope, new hope, can in fact make a change and push the world in our own small world in the direction of hope. There's kind of hopelessness, obviously, in the situation in which is created around Newtown right now of so much incredible and senseless suffering. But I think there's also hopelessness in us clutching for the assault weapons with magazines with 30 and 100 rounds. I'm also interested in attending to this kind of hopelessness that responds to hopelessness with another form of hopelessness. And that's why I invoked earlier on this idea of hope against hope, and hope being a characteristic and a character feature of the soul rather than response to circumstances. That's, I think, where we need to concentrate. How do we, in our own sphere, act in such a way as to change the situation in our small environment?
Reverend Pollock, when you come to the advice to repair the world, where are you pointing your parishioners at that point? What are you saying to them? Are you talking about, you know, be kind to your family, your neighbors? Or are you talking about activism? What's implicit there?
I'm talking about a lot of things. And I think on one hand, we are talking about activism. I actually lead a congregation that engages in a lot of activism. In fact, a number of us have been engaging in the in ways to reduce urban violence. We've been doing that for a number of years, and it's a really hard road. And certainly we want to continue with that work. I think there is a path here in the wake of this tragedy to finally do some good work around gun control. But I don't think it's only about legislation. I do think it is bigger than that. There's the mental health piece. There's the school climate piece. There's the demilitarization of our larger culture piece. And there is, Tom, you're right, the just that kindness, that do unto others, that hug your children, that take time to be in community, that take time to build relationships. I think so much of this are just natural things that we know how to do, but we don't. And I would hope that out of this moment of hopelessness and despair, that as we ground ourselves, as we breathe, as we pray, as we rediscover ourselves, that we'll be able to do that better.
There's the personal, there's the public and political. It is all part of this picture. Norfolk, Massachusetts, Marie's calling. Marie, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for your wonderful show. I guess I'll be piggybacking a bit on what your guest just said, which is that I think that in regards to hope, the hope is that this event has made so many people remember the spirit of this holiday season, and they're thinking more about their families and their friends and the teachers and people involved in our lives instead of about running around and getting their stuff. And I also think that in regards to the way that people can help, you know, this isn't like, you know, Hurricane Sandy or Katrina. We can't send money. I think the way we start is by taking care of people in our own communities, lifting our heads up and recognizing people are there. So maybe we have the opportunity to identify someone like an Adam Lanza who's in trouble before it goes too far. I think we just need to remember that it's about us, and that's the way to move through this.
That takes active caring to do that. You can't be lazy and do that. It wouldn't be easy to do that, but maybe that's exactly what it takes. Maria, I appreciate your call very much. One more, West Hartford, Connecticut. Susan. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. My name is Susan Hope. I tune into my name a lot. I work as a psychotherapist, and I thought soon into this, after hearing about this tragedy, about Adam Lanza and what could have brought him to this point. And I don't believe really that babies or children are born evil and that they are taught evil or learn it or suffer in a way that brings them to that point. So I heard actually one of the more poignant things in the aftermath was that a boy in Newtown had started a collection of violent video games, and people were depositing them in a box.
Like surrendering them, getting rid of them kind of thing.
Yes, mm-hmm. And so it made me think about the action that we can take, as previous callers have said, about really attending to the children in our midst, and all of us know somebody who's really hurting or who could develop along a violent path.
But what about our biggest culture, our bigger culture, Susan? I mean, yes, of course, take care of those right with you, reach out. But what about that boy in Newtown, if that's right, who's collecting violent video games to get rid of them? I mean, have we become lax in our culture? Are we tolerating too much that's too dark somehow, or even celebrating too much darkness?
Yes, obviously we are, but we really have to take responsibility at a basic level in our families. I mean, people have to make decisions, and we have to support one another towards hope and love and away from the support of violence.
Susan, I appreciate your call. And one more, David in Charlottesville, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a contrarian point of view about this.
Okay.
While I recognize it was a terrible tragedy, and no one could deny that, people need, instead of whining and walking around and feeling bad, they need to understand that bad things happen all the time, all around the world, and they just got to man up. They got to stop being so selfish in their whininess and just say, this is a terrible tragedy, but I have to get on with my life because I'm alive today, and that makes it a good day.
Dude, I hear that, but that also seems kind of like a shrug. These things happen, on we go. So what? Is that what you mean?
It is a shrug because I can't affect this, and people who think that they can are naive. We've had these debates for years and years and years. Nothing has changed. So focus on things that in reality you can affect, how you interact with your family, your friends. But don't be naive in thinking that you're going to somehow affect gun violence or how bad things happen.
I understand your perspective, and yet, isn't hope that we can somehow make it better necessary to endure when we see these things? I mean, Josh Pollack, there's a kind of, this is the way of the world message. And so on we go with a shrug. What do you say, Reverend?
I can't accept that. And if it's naive to think that our actions actually can make a difference, then I'm naive, and I'm happy with that, and I make no apologies.
Let's go to Chris in Natick, Massachusetts, if I may. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hi, Chris.
One quick point I wanted to make about the NRA is that I think that is an incredibly irresponsible message for them to come out with, that somehow posting signs that's a gun-free school zone attracts a mass murder. I think that's incredibly irresponsible. I think that's, blaming the victims. And I also think, their answer to everything is just industry. Let's sell more guns. But the point that I really wanted to make, and I find what that last caller said about manning up just unbelievably distressing. I mean, if somebody manned up, and that's why we don't have slavery anymore, somebody manned up, and that's why we don't have, why we're making headway with gay rights. I mean, this is a moment for activism. If you need to make a personal spiritual reflection about what happened, that's great. I grew up watching, I had violent TV shows, I had games. I grew up, my parents brought me up well. This is about personal responsibility. This is about a cultural, something's happened culturally, and I think we can affect change. And I just, that last caller is so heartbreaking to me that somehow we have to accept this. So this is a moment for activism. This is a moment for us to reflect collectively and decide what we want to be. I mean, I can't imagine just giving up. And
Chris, I hear you, and I'm with you in that determination. I appreciate your call very much. Our time grows short. Josh Pollack, you quoted in your sermon last week Seamus Heaney, the wonderful poet from The Cure at Troy, where he says, history says don't hope on this side of the grave. But you take it on from that. I don't know if you have that poem with you today, Josh, or not.
I think I do. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope. Hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells.
Seamus Heaney's the cure at Troy. Miroslav Volf, what's your last message to our listeners today of all faiths as they look out on this scene and try and find the path forward?
It's a beautiful poem, and I think the poem summarizes very much, but also my message would be, I was also disturbed by a caller previous to the last one, as if all the injustice in the world is simply some kind of a natural force with which we have to accept, embrace ourselves within ourselves in order to kind of survive it. As if much of it has not been, we are not culpable for it, and we can change it as well at the personal level, at the cultural level of the cultural imagination, at the level of law. And I think we can change, and this is what hope consists in, even in those dark days, not to be resigned and given up to hopelessness.
Well, we can understand a caller's perspective when you look at everything that's going on in the world. You remind us of intellectual and faith traditions that say hope in the face of that, and it's a reminder we can really use this week. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us. Miroslav Volf at Yale's Divinity School, director of the Center for Faith and Culture there, joining us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Thank you very much, Miroslav.
Great to be with you.
And Reverend Josh Pollack, parish minister at the Unitarian Universalist Society East in Manchester, Connecticut. Thank you, Josh, for being with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.